Dr. Paul, welcome to With the Wind, Science Revealed. Today's show, I'm interviewing two moms who both have their first child still in infancy, April and Kat, and they have their own show, Moms Off the Record. Incredible podcast about things you would want to know about if you were a new mom or a relatively new parent. We cover home birth, vitamin K shots, vaccines, co-sleeping, baby-led weaning, what to feed your baby. This is a power-packed show, especially if you have a baby in the house or one on the way. Enjoy the show. Dr. Paul, coming to you from the heart. I'm going to talk about faith over fear. You know, there can be all sorts of fears that bring you down. It could be pain, loss, being alone, helpless, death, fear of embarrassing yourself. You know, I did a lot of things to my kids where I would just say, hey, you're okay, instead of really helping them process what might have happened to them and that might have left them stuck. So instead of you're okay, how about I've got you, I'm with you, I won't leave you, and then you've got this. I also wanted to mention another little tip. It's okay to have a stuffed animal to cuddle with or a pet to cuddle with at any age. But look, I was taught this because I was always needing somebody external to come and help save me or help me with my fears. What if that person just isn't there or they're not capable of that? You can do this for yourself. I've been coached on this. I call it talking to my inner child. And that's not a unique thing. Other people have used that terminology. But to my own inner child, that insecure person that's within me that maybe is causing that fear, I can tell them, I've got you. I'm with you. I'm never going to leave you. So when you're going through times of struggle, remember, you're not alone. You can go deep within yourself. Take care of yourself. Be your own strength. You've got this. Welcome, April and Kat. It is such a privilege to have you on With the Wind.
Ditto.
Thank you for having us. We're thrilled.
You all have recently started a podcast. I'm very excited to learn more about you as people. You wrote that you pride yourselves in being very discerning, and mm-hmm. you credit your stance to the fact you've spent countless hours researching the clinical studies and dissecting VAERS, researching adjuvants, their consequences. You're true, you know, informed consent believers. Yay.
Yes.
And then you've been able to really, I think, trust your intuition, your nature over pharma, and your body's ability to overcome illnesses. So maybe just start with, take turns and tell the audience a little bit about yourselves and how you got to this place of starting a podcast. That's a big undertaking.
Yes.
Yeah.
April, you go first.
Okay. All right. We're so happy to be here and we're excited to host you too. So thank you for inviting us. But Kat and I, we were actually ironically introduced by her mother. Her mother and I did a yoga training together and I was talking to her about planning my home birth. And she's like, oh, my daughter Katie is planning the same thing. You guys should be friends. And, you know, anytime a mom tries to introduce their kids, they're like, no, probably not going to be friends. But I reached out to her and it turns out we were reading a lot of the same books and had the same philosophy around birth and motherhood, or, you know, we're first time moms. So what we anticipated motherhood to include. And once we just started vibing with each other, we're like, you know what? I'm so glad that we're not the only ones who feel this way. And there's probably a greater community out there of mothers who feel the same way. Like, let's give them a voice and let's give them some resource. It's so hard today to comb through the propaganda and try to find the true science. And so we took the onus on ourselves to do our best and equip moms with the same thing. And we did a 2-hour, no, it's more like 3.5 hours, a 2-part episode on our podcast all around the vaccine schedule for kids, and got a ton of traction from that. And so that just kind of fueled our fire to keep going. And it's now leading into early motherhood and parenthood and just living a natural, more holistic lifestyle. So that's my take on it. Kat, what's yours?
Okay. Well, not too much to add because I feel like you covered most of the bases there, but I will say this too. Anytime, especially as a soon-to-be mom or a current mom, you're trying to strike up conversation with another prospective mom friend, you know, you always end up testing the waters. You're like, should I go there? Should I mention this? You know, conspiracy theory, which often is a conspiracy fact, not a conspiracy theory, because everyone's afraid of being labeled, you know, a conspiracy theorist or, you know, an anti-vaxxer. But the truth is, after I did extensive research along with April and, you know, even before April and I met, when I started looking into these things, reading the books that April and I coincidentally both were reading, it became ever more apparent that I couldn't really justify any of the vaccines, period. I tried to make a case for it, you know, and I couldn't. And it's just really cool that, you know, we each took a chance on one another and we decided to take a risk and maybe say something that would have gotten us shunned at the local playground or park, you know. But in this case, it actually led to not only a friendship, but also this podcast where we have this incredible community of moms and soon to be moms from literally around the world. And it's interesting because before this podcast, we felt so alone and like living in silos with our thoughts and beliefs and like, oh, people would think we're crazy. But it turns out we're actually, I think, the silent majority. And Dr. Thomas, I'm sure that with, you know, former patient parents that you've spoken with, that maybe they feel similarly.
Yeah, absolutely. And your podcast is called Moms Off the Record.
Yes.
It's so great to have young moms just grabbing hold of the reins and going, hey, let's talk about these things. Because you're right. It is a difficult thing to talk about controversial topics. Depending on where you live, sometimes, yeah, you will absolutely be shunned and lose friends if you bring up, you know, taboo topics, which, you know, the health of our children should never be taboo.
It shouldn't.
And science is never settled. I mean, we're always learning from, you know, new information and, you know, figuring out some things that some of the old information was pretty manipulated. So
we
can definitely get into some of that. Let's start. I just love the fact, did you actually both have successful home births?
No. And we talk about this in one of our early episodes. So I'll be the first to say, and I am totally an advocate of owning up to or taking full responsibility of the outcomes of our choices and of our birth experiences. I am not one to point fingers, but we have early on in our podcast, we have a couple great episodes and one of them is our birth story. So April did go on to have the successful home birth. And obviously, I'm very inspired by that. I'm planning an HVAC for baby two. I'm not pregnant now, just to clarify, but when I am, I would like a home birth after cesarean. There's basically like one decision that I made that I really regret that led to the cliche and classic cascade of interventions, and it led to a failed induction, failure to progress, all of that, all because I was scared by my home birth midwives that my blood pressures were too high in the third trimester. And the thing is, I knew better at the time. I knew that high blood pressure alone was not a reason for induction. And long story short, I kept getting fear-mongered like, oh, your baby will be okay, but you might not be, mom. You might have a stroke or seizure. So the ARRIVE trial came into play, right? And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I should just get induced. And it ended up in a C-section. And this is, you know, the ARRIVE trial too is one of those things we had a great conversation with Dr. Stu about. It's one of those scams, right, that is being pushed in the Western hospital system, especially in America. And so that experience alone really lighted a fire underneath me to spread awareness about, you know, why every little thing doesn't necessarily need an induction, you know, even if minor complications do arise. An intervention. Exactly.
So folks, obviously there are some Moms Off the Record podcasts historically that you want to go visit because that topic has been covered. Outcomes for home births, C-section rates are so low. And I mean, I don't blame you, you know, in the retrospective scope, you can go, ah, I could have probably hung in there. And when you talk to Stu, you know, for sure you could have hung in there. But you know, you did what you did when you knew what you knew, and now you know different. And so thank you for spreading the word to new moms and old moms who are still going to have another child, mm-hmm. that, you know, home birth is still a really legitimate option, except for certain very high risk pregnancies. And that's where you need a good resource, whether it's mm-hmm. a STU or a trained nurse midwife. So mm-hmm. your yes. children are infants, I believe, still. Have they, either of them, had their first birthday?
Almost, but not yet.
Okay.
Yeah. And, Julian Kat's son is he's about to have his first birthday, what, next month, isn't it?
Yes, in just yes. about exactly a month.
Okay.
Yeah, and then Eden, my daughter, is 8.5 months old.
Fantastic. Yes. And it sounds like you've both made the decision not to vaccinate.
Oh yeah.
Not
even, like, and when we say not to vaccinate,
like, yeah, we are, yeah. There's under no circumstances. That's plain and simple for us at this point.
Yeah. Shamelessly, but also, like, because sometimes we get asked questions in DMs like, oh, but not even this one, like not even vitamin K, not even Hep B. It's like, nope, nada, nothing. The most that both of us have done were the oral vitamin K drops. That was mm-hmm. it. And mm-hmm. we really don't see that changing. And we're very passionate about the subject, probably just as passionate as you are. So, you know, feel free to ask us anything about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's dive down that a little bit. For the viewers, reminder, I'm retired. I don't diagnose or treat. This show is informational. And, you know, do your due diligence, dig into the research as April and Kat have. Mm-hmm. And hopefully you'll gain a deeper understanding of what the real risks and benefits are, right? It's all about informed consent. And over time, it sure took me a long time because I was in the system, right? I went to Dartmouth Medical School. I learned mm-hmm. nothing about risks of vaccines, only the benefits. And I learned a twisted historical narrative of how mm-hmm. amazing they were, right? They eradicated yes. all these horrible diseases when, in fact, if you go back and really research how much those diseases had declined by the time the mm-hmm. vaccines were introduced, you go, huh. And other diseases for which there were no vaccines also declined almost to extinctions. Like, mm-hmm. So what role did these vaccines have? But anyway, share your journey. I mean, did you both know from the get-go you weren't going to vaccinate your kids?
I attribute our decision, meaning my family's decision. Actually, I think COVID was a bit of a blessing in disguise for this, because that was the first time I was vaccinated as a child. And granted, the schedule was very different. I was born in 1990. But COVID was really the first, you know, anti-vax movement step I took, because it was just, I just felt like it was very propagandized. Like, why are you giving away guns and donuts and pizza for a vaccine? If it's really meant to be so safe and effective, then why do you have to have these really strange incentives? So that was the first time I kind of scratched my head to think, well, I don't know about this one. And then I started to feel a ton of pressure from friends and family and being labeled hateful and selfish. And here I was trying to get pregnant. It's like, well, this thing hasn't been studied. So I'm not going to introduce caffeine into my diet trying to get pregnant. So why would I even go so far as to do, you know, an experimental drug? And so that was my first glimpse into it. And then I read Aviva Rahm's book, and I was like, oh, okay. So there is this more risk versus benefit. You never hear about the risks of this, only the benefits. So this was the first exposure. I thought, oh, there's true risk involved in some of these. So it wasn't, I didn't set out on this path to come to a certain conclusion. I was very open to what I would learn about it. And then I read Dr. Sears' book. And again, it was another, you know, cost benefit analysis. And I was like, wow, that's great. And then I went to a pediatrician who was not anti-vax, but open informed consent. And she recommended dissolving illusions. So I read that one. I'm like, oh, this history is gross. The history yeah. of this is gross. Like you said, these diseases were eradicated due to hygiene standards and, you know, not drinking your own poopy water. Like, there's real, the whole thing to me just kind of looked like real industry. And anytime there's industry behind something, I tend to press against it. So it wasn't that we read these things for the hopes of validating a preconceived notion. But once you learn about these things, it's like, no. And I had chickenpox as a kid, so did Kat. And we're like, okay, so that one's, you know, so one by one, we went through and just kind of started to say, no, no, no. And then I brought this to show. I have what we call the vaccine guide in my household, which is all of the history. And once you get into that, you're like, absolutely not. So if you're willing to research it, you'll find there was no way you'd convince me to do it. And then you start to see the prevalence of childhood illness and chronic illness and diabetes in children and these allergies that are so deadly and the autoimmune and the autism. And you're like, oh, this is sad stuff. So now I'm just like, anytime somebody asks, I'm like, don't do it, but also read this so you can make that decision, you know? So that's my take.
So that vaccine guide you showed us, is that something you put together or you were able to get that somewhere?
So actually, I don't even know the girl who originally did this. I got this through a friend of the friend during COVID. So there's I believe the mom who originally started to put this stuff together had a vaccine injured child. And so that's what sparked her curiosity. And she made it available like through Facebook. It was like $100. I'm like, hell yeah. I'll pay anything to make sure I'm making the right choice for my baby. So
I would love to see that resource. I wasn't aware of that particular resource.
Yeah, I'll try and find it. I bought it, you know, in the thick of COVID, so it's older now, but it talks through all of the, you know, the vaccine injury compensation plan and the whole history of the Supreme Court cases that ruled, you know, the manufacturers to be free from liability. So you start to peel back the layers of the onion and see how it's literally designed to just rake in revenue and really has no concern for children in the next generation.
Yeah. And April, you came from a corporate world, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. I'm still in the corporate world today.
Still there.
Yeah, still there. And I would never have labeled myself as, you know, an anti-vaxxer. I grew up in a very, you know, traditional, you know, we go to the doctor, we see the pediatrician, we get our shots, all the things. I wouldn't be considered a crunchy person up until very recently. So, yeah.
And Eden is doing great, I presume.
Amazing. Like ahead. And this is another thing I love to talk about because she's what a lot of people would call advanced in a lot of her milestones. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's true. I think that she's right on schedule. And the challenge is most of our culture today are vaccinated. There's a ton of intervention throughout pregnancy and birth and early postpartum. There's the rise of formula. So there's a lot of this stuff that the baby is taking in that's delaying them. And then we see the CDC push back those milestones. So I think that Eden is just a great representation of what happens when you let your baby lead and you let nature do its thing and you don't intervene. I think it's, you know, does that make sense?
Oh, so much so. I can almost always tell just looking at a baby and the lights are on in their eyes and they've got that beautiful inquisitiveness and they're so curious. They're present. My own kids who, sadly, I was following the CDC schedule and they were kind of your age. It was still a lot of vaccines and I saw the lights go out. I mean, they were just, you know, dazed. They just looked dazed. And thankfully, they mostly recovered. But wow. Okay. How about you, Kat? Were you knowing from the beginning you weren't going to vaccinate?
No. So this started, I would say, was a very slow process that over the last few years, I did know, I would say, from the beginning of my pregnancy, I was not going to vaccinate. But in terms of my entire adult life, no, there was a lot of small drops in the bucket that happened. So big picture is, I think a lot of people are pretty shocked when they find out I come from a very medical family, like Western medical. My dad is a cardiothoracic and vascular surgeon, has been for over 3 decades. My mom was an RN, including a pediatric RN for 19 years. or sorry, not 19, 13 years before doing a career change. Then she was a flight attendant for 19 years. I have dermatologists in my family, you name it. So really traditional, right? And again, following the schedule. So little things happened, and I'll just point out a few things where I, like yellow flags or orange flags, started to go off in my head early on. For example, in middle school, when the school nurse would come around and would say, all right, everyone, this was like 2003. All right, everyone, I'm going to, you know, be administering flu shots. Make sure you bring home this permission slip to your parents, get it signed so you can get your free flu shot. And everyone's like, yep, yep, free flu shot. Sounds good. You know? And I told my mom, like, all right, I got to get my flu shot. She's like, what are you talking about? She's like, you've had the flu before, like once. Yeah, you get really sick, but then you recover. You're fine. We make you chicken soup. So from an early age, I was like, huh, that's interesting. My nurse mom is questioning the system she's a part of. I wonder why that is. That started to plant a seed. So that happened. And then I told my mom once again, remember 2006, we started seeing all the commercials for the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, or the shots, the three shot series. And I remember hearing in high school, I was like 16 at the time, all my girlfriends were like, yeah, so I just got the Gardasil shots. And then once again, I went home, I told my mom, so I guess I should get Gardasil, right? She's like, no. She said for fun, she would ask my pediatrician, yeah, I would love to see all the risks involved in this. And of course, there was a lot of gaslighting. It was super high level. It wasn't the real insert. It was the advertisement brochure, all the good stuff. So that happened. And then fast forward a bit, I started doing my own research in pregnancy because my whole life I've been into reading ingredient labels, like for food. And I was always eating organic. Like, I'm really grateful I have my mom to thank for that lifestyle and teaching me those ways. And I thought, wouldn't it be a little bit hypocritical if I was analyzing food labels on packages of pasta, but I wasn't thinking about the vaccines I'm about to put in a one-day-old baby who's my baby? Something's not adding up here. So that's when I started reading too, Dissolving Illusions. And I watched A Shot in the Dark by Candace Owens. And I just, you know, everything that's out there about vaccines, I was looking into like crazy. And, you know, I think really Dissolving Illusions, like the Bible of what's wrong, what and backwards about everything we know about vaccines, really opened my eyes. And I always say that there's some things you cannot unsee or unread. And the scary thing is, so many experts out there have not read these books that we've read. April and I haven't even been to medical school. We simply have 4-year bachelor degrees. And I feel like she and I know more than most MDs out there about the truth about vaccines. That's what's so terrifying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you absolutely do. The other thing you have that I just thank you for doing this is you trust your own intuition. And I think, you know, new moms, sometimes dads too, don't count yourselves out, dads. Do that. Trust your own intuition. Now, before I emergently lost my license back in 2020, I had lost contact with my intuition. Like it was I was a robot in a sense on that treadmill of, you know, taking care of patients. And while I had a good heart and I was pretty good at listening, I had disconnected from intuition. And I think that's the case for so many in our world today. So there's a task for the two of you in your future podcast, how to help people get back in touch with their intuition. But it's powerful, isn't it?
I'm going to drop that down as an episode topic for us, Kat, because that's incredible.
So I'm going to pivot. Thank you for both sharing that journey. Yes. And absolutely, Suzanne Humphrey's Dissolving Illusions is one of the books that kind of shook me as well because of re-clarifying the history. I mean, you know, we were just fed this vaccines are safe and effective, which is a marketing ploy. Right. And, you know, that this has been, everybody's known this since the beginning of time, and we don't want to go back to the dark ages, blah, blah, blah. But that's all misinformation, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was a wonderful book. Let's move on. Okay. So you went through your pregnancies and then you've got a newborn and you both decided not to do the vitamin K shot, but you did the oral drops. Is that true? You both did that?
Yes,
we did. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. That's what a lot of my patients were doing in my practice when I was still practicing. Never mm-hmm. had a problem with it. Never mm-hmm. had any issues, either side effects from giving the oral K or bleeding problems or whatever. Because some
However, I will say this, Dr. Thomas, because when we had Dr. Stu on, he raised a point, and I think Kat and I both were kind of like, oh, but there's some truth to that, which is like, hey, do you really think that nature made a mistake? What if it was by design that babies are, quote, deficient in vitamin K? Like maybe that's not meant to be something that develops day one. So if I were to have another baby, I think I would look into that a little bit more as to, do we really even need to do the drops? Or do we really believe that nature has made a mistake and hasn't been able to adapt for generations? So yeah. I just wanted to leave that out there too.
No, it's an excellent question. If you find something different, I'd love to hear from you. My own mm-hmm. analysis, you know, certain papers that perhaps they were, you know, how people can publish papers in a misleading yeah. way.
Sure.
There was one out of Tennessee where in the home birth community, there were 4 severe brain bleeds in people who didn't do vitamin K in one particular year. And I looked at the population and the numbers and going, that seems high enough that maybe it would warrant, but that's just one study, you know? So, mm-hmm. so anyway, I wanted to pivot to what I think, other than avoiding the vaccines, which is number one thing you should do as a parent, and do your research. Don't take my word for it. I'm mm-hmm. not giving medical advice. It's just information. But other than that, what do the two of you think would be the next most important thing you could do from the get-go for your baby?
Okay, I have some ideas. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, from day one and for as long as possible. And we have a great episode on how to meet your breastfeeding goals too on Moms Off the Record. And we invited my IBCLC, Gladys Rubio, but high level, we know that formula is not good for a baby's gut microbiome. And there's a whole laundry list of potential risks and issues, including something as simple as, let's say you are gung-ho about the formula path. Many moms are not properly boiling water and mixing it with the formula. You're supposed to boil the water first. That's just one of many examples. But talking about, you know, going back to how our ancestors were raising babies and how our bodies are designed to nurture our babies, it's really important that we give our babies the best start to life, right? So I think that would mm-hmm. be breastfeeding overall.
And did it go well for both of you right from the get-go?
We had our individual hiccups. So yeah, the answer is no. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, like a huge crisis. And trust me, we feel for the women. We empathize with women where it's just going horribly. The problem though in our culture is that at the first sign of an obstacle, right? We see it from doctors. We see it from L&D nurses, from well-intentioned family members and friends. Don't worry about trying the whole breastfeeding thing out. Just give them a little formula. And that's mm-hmm. how you really can derail positive breastfeeding for mom and baby.
It even happens before that though, Kat. Like mm-hmm. I remember in late stage pregnancy, it was like, I was hearing from friends, don't worry if it goes wrong, just have some backup formula just in case. So you're almost like conditioned before your baby even gets here that A, you're going to have an obstacle, and B, when that obstacle comes, give in, give up. So I hate that that's kind of the normal conversation of, you know, women sharing their breastfeeding challenges to, you know, expecting moms and trying to normalize and take the pressure off. But like you said, in our culture today, the first sight of any sort of obstacle, it's like, where's the next quick fix? What can we do? Instead of trying to work through that, thinking long-term benefit versus, you know, short-term yeah. frustration.
Did either of you, I feel like watching this whole saga of breastfeeding and the challenges that happen, the biggest ones that derail many moms is latch problems or pain. And the other one would be challenges with supply, so weight gain. Did either of you experience either of those and maybe want to share how you were able to overcome?
Yeah. So for me, this is Kat. There was never any issues with weight gain. It was quite the opposite. And so Julian was exceeding targets. And I know for so many moms, that is a concern. And they see how little colostrum breast milk, you know, actually your baby's taking in, and then they get scared, even though that's normal. Their stomachs are what, the size of a cherry. So for me, it was actually engorgement. I want to say on day 4 or 5, when the milk was transitioning from colostrum to mature milk. And I just feel like my left breast was just like rock hard and just huge, like super a watermelon. And that is so unlike me because I'm a very petite person. So I didn't know what to do. And Julian was struggling on one side. So what I did to overcome that was not freak out, cave in and offer the formula or like send someone to get formula or, you know, just give up. It was quite the opposite. Beforehand, I think this is key. Before you give birth, get a few local IBCLCs who have availability and can either come over or hop on a call. So I actually called Gladys and I was like crying. I was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I know I need to withdraw the milk efficiently. I don't want to cause issues. She walked me through it. She said, very normal. Like, she was so calm. She said, you need to do a combination of going in the shower and putting hot shower water on, but then also it's going to be balancing that with like an ice pack and doing like a hand massage. So with all that all day, I was eventually able to get him to latch back on and withdraw the milk. I was like, oh, and I was so relieved because I was like, oh, that's all I had to do. It was just, you know, a day's worth of work. And that could have easily been ruined. Like, I've been breastfeeding him on demand for the past 11 months. He hasn't had a sip of formula.
Wow.
In fact, he's rejected 3 bottles of my breast milk. He doesn't even want bottles, which is fine. I'm not going to push it on him. So, I mean, this boy, he's an old school boy. What can I say?
Yeah.
So I think that's the biggest thing is, don't have a knee-jerk reaction to these things. You know, women, if you're listening out there, be proactive. Get the people resources on board first so you're not looking at gadgets and products to solve your problems.
You mentioned IBCLCs. Can you explain what that acronym means and where do people find these folks?
Yes, great question. So that stands for Internationally Board Certified Lactation Consultant. And basically, there's lots of different LC types or lactation consultants. This is going to be the creme de la creme. That is not to say, want to clarify, that is not to say if you're an LC or CLC, you're not as intelligent, okay? It just means that the IBCLCs they have the most hours, the highest degree, et cetera. These are truly experts at breastfeeding. They've seen, I don't know what it is, maybe 500 hours of minimum of breastfeeding, and they've seen all different issues, right? Twins, NICU babies, et cetera. So in order to get one, well, I used word of mouth. So I got a referral. I think that's great. If you know someone else who recently had a baby, or maybe you have a midwife who works with one, I would start there. If not, I mean, for me, if I don't know, I would just do a quick Google search. But there, I'm also seeing just there's a lot of free resources too on Instagram nowadays, which is great.
Discerning those Instagram ads from, you know, predatory lactate, you know what I'm saying, where they're just going to try and sneak in some formula later. Another resource where you can try and find lactation support or other moms who are new moms or breastfeeding moms who are on the same path as you, find your local chapter of the La Leche League. There's usually a little meetup. There's a lactation consultant who leads it. And there's also a really great book. I'm blanking on the title, but I'll get it over to you, Dr. Thomas, just to troubleshoot breastfeeding without trying to introduce any other interferences like formula. And I will say, to answer your question on my side, we did have some dysfunction in the latch early on because Eden was full of ties. Tongue tie, cheek ties, lip
so
ties.
So common these days.
So common these days, which is also another whole rabbit hole. But so the first couple of days, the first 2 days, I was doing hand expression of the colostrum and giving it to her with a syringe. So I'll do anything I can to try and make sure that we could preserve that relationship. And she was able to latch it. It wasn't as efficient and it wasn't as solid. And I tried everything I could before going in and getting those released. We did a couple of chiropractic adjustments with her, but she was just full of them. And so after we got them released, I think she was 6 weeks old. Great latch, super efficient, still breastfeeding today on demand. So there could be an obstacle, but it is so worth it to get over it because it's not only beneficial. The pediatrician, when you take them in, like, oh my God, their skin is so great. They're so plump. Like you said, the light in their eyes. So not only is it healthy for baby, but it's also so important for the attachment for mom too. And I think there is an element that plays into countering any postpartum depression or the baby blues when you have that really healthy breastfeeding relationship. So,
yeah. So I'm
definitely
glad you talked about tongue tie because it is more prevalent and it's hijacking a lot of mom's ability to be mm-hmm. successful with breastfeeding. I did a half day with our local expert, Dr. Gaheri, who's written extensively on tongue tie. And let me preface it by saying this. There are some massage techniques where you can sort of help loosen the mm-hmm. under the tongue tie there mm-hmm. and avoid needing to have the little clip, the surgery, which is simple, by the way, in the hands of an expert. It's in a half day, I'm following Dr. Gaheri, and he did 8 different tongue ties in half a day using this little laser technique.
Yep.
And every single time, so we'd go in, he'd explain it, we'd take the baby, go do the procedure, bring the baby back, go ahead and breastfeed, we'll be back to see how it went. And then we go on to the next baby. When we came back, every single mom goes, oh my goodness, I should have done this
yes.
sooner.
Yes.
So, you know, before you give up, right? I mean,
yes.
if you can do some natural things to avoid surgery, always. But mm-hmm. before you give up, give this consideration because it sounds like you had a good experience with it. Mm-hmm. The massage afterwards hard, isn't it? Because it hurts. It hurts the baby.
Oh, yeah. She didn't love it. But I think just that what made it worth it, because we also, being more holistic and naturally minded, was like no Tylenol or no, you know, Gen X or anything like that. We just wanted to, breast milk is best. So that was a little bit of a struggle. I think the second afternoon after the release is when she started to feel it the most, but I just put her on as often as I could. And I think that really started to rebuild the relationship too. And it was the next day she was kind of back. The massages are terrible. I couldn't do them. I had to have my husband do them. I'm like, I'm not hurting my baby, but it's totally worth it. Totally, totally worth it. To
actually, that was really brilliant. Having your mm-hmm. husband do the massage. So what mm-hmm. you have to do, folks, is they've snipped under the tongue,
mm-hmm.
under there. And you yeah. have to massage so it doesn't scar back down.
Right, exactly.
And I've had only a couple instances, but I've seen maybe at least 100 tongue tie revisions and the little surgeries where they snip that or laser it rather. And I've only had a couple where it scarred back down, but it can scar down even worse. Mm-hmm. And I only had one situation where the baby didn't want a nurse anymore because I think associating pain with mom.
Yeah.
And so it really messed things up. So you bring up a clever idea. Have the dads do that. Mom, yeah. you're the one that's providing the yummy milk yeah. and the relief.
Right. We're the saviors.
Yep. You can be the savior. It's actually yeah. a brilliant idea. Yeah. Now, at some point, you both will probably wean. And yeah. I'm curious
one
about,
day.
I read yeah. something where I think you're both proponents of baby-led weaning. I'd be interested in each of you sharing, you know, what your plans are because you're still both breastfeeding. Have you started solids? How's that going to go for you? What are your plans? And to maybe explain baby-led weaning.
Yeah. yeah. We're not wedding our babies just yet.
Not yet.
Give them a couple years for that. But they grow up so quickly. But yeah, this is something April and I are super passionate about. also because it has that holistic, you know, nutritional element. And we know that in order to feel like you are thriving, nutrition is really the foundation of everything. And we see it so often, right? You go to a restaurant or you're out and about, and this is by no means to shame anyone. I get it. Like, being a parent is really tough and sometimes you're exhausted, but when the pouches and the baby food jars are out more often than real food in front of the baby, maybe that's when we need to reevaluate how we are feeding our children, quite simply. Mm-hmm. So basically, with baby-led weaning, a lot of doctors will still recommend, you know, offer solids, which is really anything except for infant milk, so even purees before 6 months. But the newer research has shown that babies are not developmentally ready or gastrointestinally ready to consume anything but infant milk until they're at least 6 months and showing other signs of readiness, such as sitting up relatively unassisted, right? The extrusion reflex is no longer there. For example, they're showing that interest in food. So once you have that down, and for Julian, that was at about 6.5 months. So a little bit closer to the 7 month mark, which is okay, but it's really tricky, right? Because so often you're going to get pressure from relatives of an older generation or other friends or experts to start your baby on solids earlier, but there's really no added advantage to doing that. So it is worth the wait. So April and I have both been feeding our babies real adult food that we cook from scratch. You know, we make an effort to go to the best local markets or farmers markets, what have you. And kind of the formula that we try to use, because this is something that we talk about on a daily basis. We're constantly inspiring one another with different recipes and things. So we know that babies need the majority of their non-milk calories from a healthy carbohydrate, right? Like a fruit or vegetable or a grain. We try to use ancient grains like millet or sorghum or teff, trying to avoid white flour. Yeah. Bulgur. What else? Yeah. So protein. So then we have a healthy protein, right? So a lot of people are terrified, or they think that you can't offer a baby meat or fish. And the truth is, you can offer your baby certain cuts of meat, especially if they're easily shreddable. So think about the types of meat that you would throw into a slow cooker. Those are great with a little bit of bone broth. So obviously nothing like lean or like no hard dry meats, and then fish, right? So because we know that the cord blood that the baby received is going, the benefits of that starts to kind of go away after the 6 month mark. Mm-hmm. And so many young kids are deficient in iron. Mm-hmm. That's very common. So by offering your babies meat and teaching them how to feed themselves, so we're not doing the choo-choo train of spoon feeding, there's so many advantages, right? And your babies can have a diet that's rich in a bioavailable iron and zinc and B12. I look at so many kids that are out at these restaurants, you know, toddlers, babies, they're eating from the sugary plastic pouches. You know, we have to ask ourselves, what were our grandparents doing before the plastic pouches and the baby food jars, right? They were simply offering the same foods that the rest of the family was having in a safe manner, in smaller portions, right? So you have a healthy carb, you have a healthy protein, and we like to offer a healthy fat that can be anything from coconut milk or avocado, you name it. But our babies are a few months apart. So Julian reached his milestone. I wanted him to offer him over 100 new foods before he turned one. That happened at 10 and a half months. Eden is trailing right behind him.
At 75. She's at
that
75.
That is very impressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because she has a few months.
Impressive. That's super impressive. Talk about, just because this is, I did my baby's last one's 26 years ago, and I didn't do it right at all. It is what it is, but you guys are, you're exciting me with this information. So help some new moms who are watching this. Where do you start? Which foods maybe do you start first? And is it absolutely no spoons, or can you take home cooked really good food and assist them?
April, do you want to answer this one?
You go ahead. You're the baby-led weaning expert, but I will say this. The thing that drove me to this, before you get into explaining how to help moms, the thing that drove me to a crazy point is I told you, Dr. Thomas, how we were kind of concerned about this higher incidence of childhood obesity. And it's sad. And we're seeing that the reaction is, oh, let's just do some gastro surgery on these children, right? Yeah. So that's a whole nother rabbit hole. The thing that peeves me is when you go to a restaurant, the kids' menu is often chicken tendies, pizza, spaghetti, and it's these brown foods. And so the whole reason that I'm excited about baby-led weaning is to teach Eden early that those foods aren't real foods. Those are food-like things. And we really want to focus on healthy foods, having a good quality food. So anyway, the baby menu, the kids menu in restaurants really drives me crazy. But go ahead, teach us how. Cat.
Like, well, likewise. And just real quick to clarify my why, and then I'll talk about the spoons, is I have really fond memories when I was like 3 years old, standing on the toddler tower next to my mom in the kitchen, making like real gourmet meals, you know, that were simple, but gourmet, you know, like lamb chops with rosemary and lemon potatoes, like lots of Mediterranean food. And I specifically remember like having a more adventurous palate than my peers. And then I remember in high school, even I would have some classmates who were eating peanut butter on Wonder Bread with the crust cut off. And I was like, this is so opposite to what like I learned at home. And I just want for Julian to him to have an open mind when it comes to food. Mm-hmm. How cool is it to be able to take your kid to a restaurant anywhere in the world of any cuisine, and they're ordering essentially from the adult menu, or they're willing to try anything mom and dad are trying. Like, I mm-hmm. love that quality in a child. So about the spoons, people often think baby-led weaning is just, okay, you're doing solid foods instead of purees. But the bigger picture, and if you break down baby-led weaning instead of adult-led weaning, is you're teaching your baby how to feed himself or herself. So that can be either picking up the food literally with your fingers, which is what they do at first. Using the spoon, them using the spoon or the fork is a milestone that comes a little bit later, and that's totally mm-hmm. normal. I still will put the utensils, the little silicone utensils, in front of Julian, and I model. So I try to eat the same things. It doesn't always work out that way. Sometimes I do eat different things, but I try to, and we try to eat meals at the same time at the table as a family. No, like, here's your snacks in your stroller, reclined, that's a choking hazard, or, and also there's no snacks, right? So we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I try not to go more than 5 hours without a meal, but snacks are the antidote to having a full appetite at mealtime. So mm-hmm. kids don't need snacks. I know I'm going to get a lot of hate for saying that, but they don't if they're having a big breakfast, lunch, and dinner that's nutritious. So here's the thing. If you really want to be religious about baby-led weaning, technically mom and dad is not supposed to spoon feed the baby. Mm-hmm. And look, it's not the end of the world if you're going to do it, because I get it. It can be fun and cute to feed your baby. But the idea is, let's give them the independence and the skill set to do that on their own, because they will if you let them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. By loading the spoon for them, and then they'll grab it and instinctively put it in their mouth. And it's the coolest thing when they finally do that. It's like everybody's celebrating. So
yes.
But you asked too, like, what foods to get started with. So we are both proponents of a program called Baby Led Wean Team on Instagram at Baby Led Wean Team. Katie Ferraro, she's an RDN mom of six.
So, or Baby Led Weaning Made Easy.
Maybe. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Baby Led. And so she has an entire program of how to start. The foods to start with. She has a list of 100 foods broken by fruit, vegetable, grains, and proteins, and potential allergens. So this is another thing that we want to expose our children to early, despite the criticism of the industry. You need to be exposing your baby early and often to the potential allergens.
Agreed.
Especially if they were vaccinated, because we want to make sure that they can build their system. And so thankfully, none of our babies have shown any sort of signs against peanut or fish or wheat or dairy. So she has an entire program on that, super informative. So if you're trying to get started, check out her Instagram first. There's a ton of free resources there. And then she also has a free workshop to get started. And then, of course, when you watch that, you're going to have to buy the program because it's amazing. But
and that's what
really
happened to
cool.
me.
Like we are proud to say that our, like, I was a very picky child because of my childhood. It was a lot of chicken tendies and spaghetti and all that stuff. And that's fine. But because of my baby, I was like, you know what? I've got to expand my palate too. So because of Eden, I'm now starting to eat more nutritious things and becoming more conscious around ingredient labels. And Eden's eaten lamb and tuna and, well, not tuna, but salmon and like crazy things that I would never eat. Like I wouldn't eat any fish. So that kind of stuff is cool too, when you get to see your baby thrive. And I know Julian's had even crazier, cooler food than that. But thinking about an 8-month-old baby eating a deep cuisine is kind of cool.
We love
it. So just for fun, rattle off some of the first 10 foods you started out with.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in all honesty, the first few foods, anytime you're starting baby-led weaning, might be a little bit more like the foods that anyone would offer because you want to ease your way into it. So maybe we could do the first 10 that we start off with. So, but then maybe we'll tell you the craziest.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would say it was avocado, and this is just going off. I mean, this was a few months ago now. So avocado, a lot of people think you cannot offer a baby, especially a baby with no teeth, apple, but I'll tell you how you do it. You skin the apple and then you slice the apple into strips that are the size and shape of your adult pinky finger, and you poach it or boil it in water to make it soft. So as long as it passes the squish test and has some give, like really a lot of give, you're fine. So apple, avocado, also
sweet potato.
Duck. Yeah, sweet potato. Just so happened duck from some duck carnitas. Yes. Egg. So Julian has had hard boiled, omelet, scrambled, sunny side up, you name it. Also beef liver, homemade beef liver was one of the first ones I offered from the Lily Nichols Real Food for Pregnancy book. So a lot of moms are scared to offer their baby's liver because of all the vitamin A. But the thing is, the synthetic vitamin A is very different, or the beta carotene vitamin A, right, is very different from vitamin A you naturally find in nature, like from an animal. Mm-hmm. We all know you cannot overdose from supplements from real food or an animal. You can only overdose from supplements. So don't be afraid of liver moms out there. What else? Oh gosh. I'm sort of blanking, but
like basic fruits and veggies, just soft. And then you can start to move into the softer proteins, like the shredded beef and fish are really easy for them to get through. So it's pretty cool. And then you can start, once you do a few of those whole foods alone, then you start to introduce combination foods where you're putting a whole meal together and mixing the two things or three things together. So it's a great program. I can't recommend it enough.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that in such a great way. I like hitting some controversial topics because
we do too.
You guys are used to this. So, I am kind of ashamed of how I did this, but it was survival for myself. So it was selfish. When I was growing up, if I had a terrible nightmare, went to my parents' room at age, whatever, 5, 6, 7, I would be marched back to my room. And I've done my own work and realized that was actually pretty distressing to me and traumatic. I was busy with a practice that I was building, working 7 days a week from, you know, I started my day at 6:30, cook a pot of oatmeal, leave it for the kids. And I was gone. I'd come back about 10 o'clock at night. They were half of them in bed and I needed my sleep so I could continue that cycle. So I followed my parents' modeling and, you weren't to interrupt me at night. And I feel like what I needed and my three biological boys definitely could have benefited from was more nurture. And talk about bed sharing and how you see how you see sleep and what might be optimally nurturing and less stressful and developmentally appropriate. And run with that for a little bit.
We love to talk about this so much so we did an episode on bed sharing and co-sleeping in general if you can't do safe bed sharing. The one thing that I think we need to remind parents, especially new parents, is when you're making the choice to bring new life into this world, it is meant to be inconvenient for a long time. And that's okay. We need to normalize the inconvenience of rearing children in the early days. So Kat and I both bed share. I've been bed sharing since literally day one, bringing Eden in on the bed there. And it's really hard to be in today's culture and be a bed sharing parent. So we just want to normalize this, that it's normal. It develops really great attachment, especially if you can breast sleeping. It protects against SIDS to bed share. You become more attuned to your baby. It preserves the breastfeeding relationship. So there's a ton of benefits despite the inconvenience that some people would say, or the spoiling of your baby, or you're going to create a monster. They're never going to be able to sleep on their own. And I like to combat that by saying, do you like to sleep alone? As an adult, I go to bed with my husband every night. I would hate to go to bed by myself.
And now some do.
Brand new baby,
but we're not.
But like a brand new baby who has been in your womb for so long, and the comfort and every need ever met there, and then we're supposed to just put them in a cage in another room. It just sounds counter to the nature. So we love bed sharing. It's taken Eden, she's 8.5 months, and she just had her first stretch of uninterrupted 5-hour sleep in her crib last night's first nap. So I say that because a lot of moms think weeks that they should be sleeping on their own, and that's not the case. It's not biologically normal to be doing that. And we're seeing predatory marketing from the sleep industry to say, oh, just buy these diapers. These diapers will help your baby sleep through the night, or this sleep sack, or this snoo, or this crazy bassinet, or swaddle them, which we know inhibits the integration of their reflexes. It's really sad because, especially as new moms, you're just bombarded with propaganda and advertisement and marketing to say that your instincts are wrong. You can't do this alone. Buy this thing. And you had said, Dr. Thomas, like you had felt like you had pulled away from your, how did you say it? Your instincts, your, I forget what you said.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I was nurturing enough. And
well, that, yeah.
Putting kids who are already stressed, and I had high anxiety boys, even as toddler, these have infants, isolating a person who's anxious. I mean, that sounds horrible.
But well, intuition was the word you used. You had become detached from your intuition. Mm-hmm. And that's what the last point I was going to make is all of this marketing and this advertisement really kills mother's intuition. So Kat, what do you want to say about bed sharing?
Well, I second everything that you've said. So April mentioned that they started bed sharing from day one. We actually didn't start until week one. And the first week, so I was, you know, post C-section recovery. It was an unplanned, your most cliche cascade of interventions, traumatic C-section birth when I was planning a home birth. So I was dealing with that physically and emotionally and trying to make sure that I exclusively breastfeed. So you can imagine all those factors combined, it really didn't make, you know, breastfeeding on demand easy when you're also being told, yeah, just keep your baby, you know, alone on the back in the crib or bassinet. So we had one of those tiny, really chic looking by Nestig, one of those bassinets on wheels that I put right up alongside my husband because I wasn't on any narcotic pain relief for the C-section because I'm holistic. So I didn't do any morphine or anything strong. So Eric, my husband, had to pick up our son and then pass him over to me so I could nurse in the bed. Then I would pass him back over to him. It was a nightmare. It was just exhausting. So I started casually on Instagram. I would see like, oh, there's these other crunchy moms and they're talking about how they safely bed share. And I started seeing that in pregnancy. And I was like, I was kind of scared at first to bring it up to my husband, like maybe he won't like this idea. And I was like afraid of the rejection, like that would come from him. But instead, because I have a sales background, I was in software sales for 8 years prior to being a stay-at-home mom full-time. So I was like, how can I sell this idea to Eric? And so I was like, doing the, okay, here's the quick and dirty bottom line up front. This is why it's better for you, for me, for our baby. And I was like, guess what? The bottom line is we're all going to sleep better. And here's why. Okay. And I'll be happier, happy wife, happy life. I'll be happier because breastfeeding will be going well. You're going to sleep better. Lo and behold, I was right. And we all slept better because we know from our research and the research of Sarah Buckley and Dr. James McKenna of Safe Infant Sleep that babies do sleep better when they can sense that they're in close proximity to their main caregivers. So just another way to actually combat potential postpartum depression and postpartum mood disorders by keeping up the breastfeeding relationship and getting better sleep and everyone's in a better mood. It's so easy, especially if you've had a C-section and you're not on narcotic pain relief, to literally roll over. It's like one quick motion and do some side-lying breastfeeding instead of let me just exhaustedly walk to the nursery, sit myself down. Okay. Turn on a light. Now I have to make sure I don't accidentally fall asleep in the chair nursing my baby, which actually is a death trap, ironically, but that's what the Western model wants you to do.
Perfect. We're going to have to wrap it up because we're out of time. We could do two shows. So enjoying talking to you two. On the sharing of beds, I used to advise if parents were drinkers, then they need to be careful. Or if mom is has exceptionally large breasts, there's more of a smothering risk if you're not awake enough to know what's going on. Yes. Do you have there any other?
Ours are big, but not that league. Big.
Yeah, the La Leche League actually puts out something called the Safe Sleep 7. So I would encourage your listeners to check that out. It's definitely if they're on medication, if they're overweight, obese, if they have a hard time waking, which you probably won't as a brand new mom when your baby cries. But there are also some recommendations of how to make your bed safe for your baby because you don't want to put them in a place where they could suffocate. So it's about making sure your bedding is below them and there's not a pillow that they could get squished in between. So check out the Safe Sleep 7 to make sure that you are a candidate for bed sharing. And if not, you can still co-sleep with the crib or the bassinet in your room, which would be better than
listen to our episode on bed sharing as well.
Thank you, April and Kat. And folks, go to Moms Off the Record and you can get more of this wisdom dialed in on the topic that you need to study.
Yes. Thanks for watching, everybody.
Thank you.
I look forward to running together with the wind at our backs, revealing the science that gives clarity in our world that's full of propaganda and misinformation. Visit our website, doctorsandscience.com. Sign up. Donate if you can. Your support makes a difference. And let's make this the weekly show the world has been waiting for. Thanks for watching. I'm Dr. Paul.